Okay, I'd like to call to order the February 28th meeting of the Governance Committee. First item of business is approval of the agenda. I would like to add one item, just a brief discussion of upcoming agenda for the Governance Committee, and just to kind of give everybody a little heads up. With that in mind, is there a motion to approve the agenda?
All right. Second.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Next, you have before you the minutes from the February 14th meeting. Hopefully, everybody's had a chance to review those. Is there a motion or any?
Mr. Dyke?
Yes, ma'am.
I just, from a technical point of view, you don't have a person here from the district, so you can't actually have votes that count. You just need somebody. Otherwise, the committee isn't fully constituted. A quorum.
You don't have a quorum without someone from the district.
Oh, okay. Very good. All right. Well, we'll come back and approve the agenda in a minute, in a few minutes.
I won't come anymore.
No, please. If we're doing something that's not appropriate, I want to have it pointed out. So, so at least I know that I'm being inappropriate. All righty. Well, while we're waiting for Mrs. Bowser so we can take a couple of votes, the one action item we have is the approval of the Board Code of Ethics. And when we get to that point, I'm going to have the General Counsel give us an overview of hopefully what will be something that won't evoke too much discussion, because we had a pretty thorough discussion earlier. And Mr. Downs, how are you?
I'm just a pigeon.
We're waiting on Ms. Bow. Oh, he's here. You can. Good. You're good. Okay. You get my corn. Okay.
Good as they come. Hi.
All right. Now we will back up. We have an amended agenda. Is there a motion to approve the agenda as amended?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstain? We also have before you the minutes from our February 14th meeting. Hopefully everybody's had a chance to look over those. Are they, is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
All right. And I heard a second from Artis. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstain. All right. The one action item we have is approval of the Board Code of Ethics. And before I ask the General Counsel to give us an overview, I want to take this opportunity, since this is my first meeting, to thank the chair and the vice chair of the previous governance committee, Ms. Hines, who's here, and Mr. Barnes, who's not here, for all the hard work that went into making these changes. It's been an ongoing process, very detailed, and everyone, I think, has done a yeoman's job. And I think we have a package that reflects a lot of discussion, a lot of changes, a review of our outside consultants' recommendations. And hopefully we'll have something that we can move through fairly quickly. So with that lead-in, I will now turn to our General Counsel, who will give us an overview based on the action taken at the February 14th meeting. Ms. O'Keefe?
Thank you, Mr. Dyett, members of the committee. I want to direct the committee's attention first to the resolution, actually, because and hopefully to the red line, or because in addition to the changes to the ethics code, the committee also recommended that there be conforming changes to the procedures. And rather than attach the whole procedure, what we've done is simply set forth the proposed change to the procedure on page 2 of the resolution. So the procedure section 10 is conformed to the concept of the executive committee. But we did make a few what I call editorial changes. So this is how allegations of misconduct will be handled procedurally. If there's an allegation of misconduct, it goes first to the executive committee. If a member of the executive committee is the object of the allegation, then of course that member is excluded from review. And then we proposed a slight change to the language, which would say, except as authorized by the executive committee, the Audits and Investigations Committee, or the Audits and Investigations Committee, the Inspector General will not investigate these types of allegations. And then it goes on to say the Executive Committee shall convene an executive session to determine appropriate action, which if there were a follow-on action, it would be a referral to the Audits and Investigations Committee, as occurred, for example, recently in the investigation that was conducted. So that's just the conforming change to the procedures. We didn't really discuss it in depth, but I think it comports with the committee's action. So then moving quickly through the actual code of ethics, of course, the first change was to indirect financial interest. I'm not really going to pause on any of these. I'm just going to go through them. I believe they were discussed in detail.
Carol, could you pull the mic a little closer?
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Oh, yeah. Phil has reminded me on page one. There's also a reference that the bylaws will require the board to maintain and periodically update the rules contained in the Board of Ethics. And then there's also a cross-reference to the joint development guidelines, and that these the ethics code applies to joint development projects. So that was an action of the committee last time. And again, on page two, and I'm referring to the markup. Page two, we've got the change to indirect financial interest. And so the 3% trigger relates to income coming to a member, household member, or business associate. And there's a definition of gross income. We're really simply using the IRS definition. That's on page three under prohibited conflicts. Those are just really more editorial changes. I don't think there is a fairly new section on page four under recusal and advisory opinions. And this allows a board member to notify the executive committee of a situation that creates or might create a conflict or appearance of conflict. It sets up the recusal obligation and a notification obligation on the part of the board member. There's also a reference to the form that's used for recusal, and that's an attachment. And then E2 requires a board member to recuse him or herself immediately if he finds out or she finds out of a situation after there's been some participation. Then three.
May I?
Question.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Bowser.
So recusal is a notification. It's not a request. And I notice in the form says such, but in the code it says it outlines a request. I just want to make sure that's clear.
I'm sorry.
I'm looking at page four.
Well, it's just a request that the board members reflect that recusal.
I'm sorry?
The request is simply that that the minutes reflect the nature of the conflict. The recusal, of course, is completely up to a board member.
We don't need to request that the minutes reflect something that was said, right? So I think it should be, to be consistent, it should say that, it suggests that a member has to get permission from the executive committee to be recused. And that's not the case. The member notifies the board that he or she is recused, and the minutes reflect that because that's what was said. So I would strike the word recusal, or hold on, let me find out where I am, request, and say the board member will notify the executive committee using the form in attachment C. The words and request I would move to strike.
Okay. And then you'd also, I guess, have to then change it to say, and the board minutes will reflect the nature of it, so that grammatically it flows.
Well, exactly. I mean, we can revise it so it simply states that the board, the minutes will reflect that recusal.
Sure. That's, but the recusal is mandatory. It's a shall recuse.
Right.
Yes. Mr.
Chairman. Well, that raises another issue.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
This first paragraph flips between will and shall. Some sentences say will, some say shall. I would just suggest we say shall consistently throughout. Then there's just not a question, and shall is really a requirement generally in this kind of a document. So there's one in the first line, and then in the sentence we were just talking about where the request language used to be, it also says the board member will. So I think if we change those wills to shall in those two places, then we have consistency throughout the paragraph.
Okay.
We members, can do that.
Members can comfortable with that? So, well, one of the members make a motion that we will amend these two sections to reflect the changes made, requested by Ms. Bowser and by Ms. Hines.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
All right, it's been moved and seconded that we make the grammatical changes that were referenced earlier. Madam General Counsel, you've got all those?
Yes.
Could somebody maybe read that last sentence, because we've now made quite a few changes to it, so we're all clear.
The board member will notify the executive.
Shall.
Okay. The board member shall notify the executive committee using the form in attachment C, and the board minutes shall reflect the nature of the conflict of interest and the reason for the recusal on the matter. Okay?
Yes.
All righty. Moving right along.
So the E3 on that page, the next provision, is offers board members the opportunity to seek verbal or written guidance from the ethics officer, a position that's created a little bit later, regarding the application of the code to specific questions. And then 4 is the safe harbor provision that the committee asked be included in the ethics code. So it reads that no member may be found. Ooh, okay. Let's say no member will be found. I actually think will is better here, unless, or we could use shall at the committee's direction. Sound
any,
to a violation.
Any thoughts on that, Ms. Bowser?
Forgive me if we've had this conversation, but I'm not remembering. Did we address here if the opinion shall be public?
Didn't talk.
We did not address it. That's completely at the committee and board's discretion.
Okay.
But I do not believe it was discussed in the committee deliberations. So putting that for discussion, the essence of 4 is that if a board, I'm not going to read it, everybody can read it. The essence is if a board member seeks an opinion from the ethics officer, relies on it, then that member will not later be found to have violated the ethics code if, of course, the member acts in accordance with that advice or guidance.
Okay.
So it's a safe harbor provision. It's largely modeled on the MWA provision that Mr. Danny directed our attention to.
And that's only, Mr. Chairman, a safe harbor with respect to actions that this board might take.
It's relative to our
not,
code of
right,
ethics.
Can't control outside.
Oh, right, exactly.
Right, legal actions that might be brought.
With respect to the ethics code.
Yeah,
ethics code.
Any other comments on those, on that new section? Because what I'd like to do is, if you hold 1 second, I stopped to read the last sentence, but we didn't actually vote on the amendment. So there was a motion made to make the changes alluded to.
Well, you can wait until you go all the way through and just scoop up all the amendments. That's your choice.
That's good. Well, I just want to do it now, so I was fresh in our minds. So all those in favor of those amendments, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Recusal? Okay, your question.
Mr. Dyke, I think Ms. O'Keefe is right that may is too soft a word here. So, you know, in, I think if we're going to use shall, let's use shall, then it's clear to the to some subsequent board of directors that there wasn't a there wasn't wiggle room here. The board meant to say, you know, if you do this and you rely on it, that the board isn't going to come back and question you. So I would suggest we do shall.
Okay. So has a member of the committee wants to make a motion to that effect?
So moved.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded that we change may to shall. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? Okay.
Mr. Guy.
Yes, ma'am.
I do think that either in the code or in the procedures, we should, the board should consider affirmatively saying if the opinions will be like public opinions or confidential opinions.
Okay. Well, you want to make that in the form of a motion so we can have some discussion on it?
Well, I do. I don't know that I'm prepared to do it now because I think we should look at the way some others are done, and that may be something that we come back to.
Okay. All right. Well, actually, skipping ahead to the next item on the agenda, I was going to talk about some of the things we have to do going forward, and one of which is obviously to continue to monitor the Code of Ethics. So we will capture it in the future discussions, if that's okay. And I'm assuming that Mr. Barnes and Ms. Hines, that issue didn't come up at all during your discussion.
It did not.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Current practice is that our ethics annual statements and any decisions that the General Counsel has made with regard to them have been made available through Freedom of Information, right?
I'm sorry, Mr. Downing. That would not be the case with respect to advice that the General Counsel gives
okay.
to any individual board
okay.
member,
that would be legal.
Whether oral yeah. or written. As to the disclosure
yeah.
Forms and the refusal forms also yeah. as well, those would be public. Those would be available to the public. And I okay. believe the board and the committee has expressed a view that, of course, the purpose of the disclosure statements is sunshine and transparency. My oral and written advice has not been made available, and I would not because generally it's sought in confidence. But, of course, depending on the committee or board's decision, there could be a determination that that would be open to the public. Now, the ethics officer is not identified as it's been drafted. It's up to the executive committee. So... Of course, if it were an attorney, there would be attorney-client issues, but that's always a privilege that can be waived by the client. So it's completely a policy call. Next session.
Before you go on, let me make 2 points. One is I'd just like to ask everyone to please speak clearly into the microphone so that you can be heard in the room. And second is I'd like to ask staff to begin to do some research on the question of the public opinion, whether we'd make the opinion public. And when you feel you're ready for that, we will add it onto the agenda for upcoming meeting for some discussion. Okay?
Will do.
Okay.
So then the next session is the fairly substantial rewrite of the solicitation, non-solicitation, and the limits on gratuities. And it did take up the recommendations that the Cadwallader firm made substantially, although not in entirety. But for purposes of clarity, this rewrite really simply breaks down the prohibitions on solicitation and the prohibitions on gratuities. So the intent is to make clear as we possibly can, the provisions of the existing ethics code, because we did agree with the Cadwallader firm that there was not perfect clarity. So I'm not going to go through all this unless the committee wants me to. It's largely the same as the current ethics code, but I believe there's quite a bit better clarity.
Very good. And then there was a lot of discussion at the last governance committee meeting. So unless there are any questions anyone has, we'll want to move to the next provision.
So then I'm going to move on to page six. Mm-hmm. And
clarifying question. Provision four, three and four, I ended up reading two or three times because I wanted to be very clear about
page six.
Page five.
Okay.
Regarding the solicitation for religious, charitable, or political contributions. Kara, can you just tell me in plain words what that means exactly?
So it takes into account the prohibitions in 1, 2, and 3. So you have to start with probably 2.
Right.
So a board member, household member may not solicit anything of value from a party with an actual or prospective business relationship with the authority. And the prohibition is not intended to preclude solicitations of the general public by mass mailing or other anonymously directed solicitations. And that's really sometimes campaign contributions or things of that just go out to a broad range of people without any particular direction. So it might incidentally be addressed to a party with an actual or prospective business relationship, but if it's a part of a mass mailing, that's not a violation. So that's the first. Secondly, board members and household members may not solicit anything of value from the authority or any WMOD employee. So that prohibition is intended to prevent elected officials from using their position to gain political contributions. However, again, it doesn't prevent the type of mass mailing that I have just spoken of. So then 4 says if you comply with all of those, with provisions 2 and 3, then there's no problem with a board member, household member, soliciting bona fide religious or charitable or political contributions. So we're making it as clear as we possibly can what the prohibitions are and then what board members can do. And again, I think it largely is intended to make clear when board members who are elected officials can solicit contributions from either parties to a WMATA contract or employees. So then,
why don't I just share the specific concern I have that's given me some heartburn and why I read it 2 or 3 times. I beg a lot for good causes, Community Foundation, Girl Scouts, Girls Inc., and I host political fundraisers for candidates that I believe in. And what's defined as a mass mailing versus my network of people that I go to help support causes, it's a slippery slope for me. So I certainly want to make sure I'm in compliance, but this provision caused me to read it 3 or 4 times. And I would not like to be in a position where I'm precluded for raising money for important causes like the Community Foundation and otherwise, and in supporting candidates that I believe in and align with their philosophies. So I'm looking for guidance, and that's the reason I raise this particular. I'm not an elected official, but I'm very involved in my community.
I don't believe this will cause you any problems. I believe that those activities are consistent with the way the ethics code is written.
Okay, but I will be seeking a written opinion from the ethics council every time. That's what this suggests to me.
So this is, but the bottom line on this, and I think, let me just finish with 4. So having set up the situations that are prohibited and allowed, the final sentence makes it clear that the board member can accept contributions that have been solicited only to the extent that it's consistent with the law of the board member's jurisdiction and where it cannot be reasonably inferred that the contribution is offered in an effort to influence the member's action upon an authority matter or offered as a reward for the board member's action upon an authority matter. So that's the bottom line of that whole section. I mean, that's why we, I really feel as the author of this, why so much pain were taken to make clear what was acceptable and unacceptable. The bottom line is, if, for example, the board member's activity in soliciting campaign contributions is consistent with the law of his or her jurisdiction, and no inference can be made that that is being done in an effort to affect the board members, that the contribution is being done in an effort to affect the board members' action on a WMATA matter, then there's no problem with it. So, and that's I hope, fairly clear. Yeah. But of
it
course,
is. Let me just say this, Carol. I think part of my sensitivity is a previous board discussion we've had around our need as board members to know who we're doing business with. And I had a particular situation recently where I saw the list of individuals involved in a transaction, and it turns out I did know that person and had had dinner with that person. Never discussed Metro because anything, but I think it will heighten our concern around being informed of who the authority is doing business with, because it creates an appearance. And so it's not just the actual conflict I'm concerned about, it's the inference and appearance.
Very good point.
Okay.
So I'm not suggesting you need to solve the problem, but I just wanted to disclose what the underlying concerns are for me.
It is something I've thought about quite a bit, and I've also discussed it with others in the authority. We don't, we do have, for example, in joint development, the appropriate communications about the members of joint development teams, and frequently they are many members, many legal entities, and sometimes individuals. We don't have the same thing for the totality of the board's contracting, because it's a huge contracting effort. Some on big contracts, and there are a lot of those, the opposite party can be identified. We do a lot of small, simplified acquisitions. But it is something that I've been discussing with our procurement officer, because I appreciate that it is difficult for board members to really know the totality of the entities with which WMATA does business. Now, under the current delegation, it's available, but it's available in a lot of different pieces. Under the current delegation, the board does not, as a rule, act on procurement matters, but of course it does in joint development. So, but I appreciate the concern you've expressed.
Very good. And just for the record, I should note that one individual you're alluding to, I think we both know that person, so that's why this whole idea of trying to figure out who's involved in what deal is something that's very important to us. And also, just on a point of personal privilege, you were talking about reaching out to your entire network of friends on these various and sundry things, and knowing you, I think that would amount to a mass mailing.
That was a low blow. But they're good causes.
Okay. All right. Madam General Counsel, you want to move ahead?
So then the second section is rewritten, and it addresses limits on gratuities. Again, there has been no substantive change in this section. It's just been, I hope, clarified. Now I want to move to page 6, and it's H6 at the bottom of the page, the red line. Now, this is the nepotism provision that the committee discussed last time. So it's under use of official position. So this is at the end of a long list of the board members shall not. So they shall not take part in or advocate for any hiring, employment, or contracting decision relating to a spouse, child, sibling, parent, aunt, uncle, first cousin, nephew, or niece. And then the parenthetical identifies those relatives as qualifying relative and then that includes persons related by law or consanguinity, and domestic partners. I'm quite fond of consanguinity as a word myself. So, and then there's a recusal provision if that should come up in an employment action that the board is directly involved in. And as you know, there are a few of those. So that is that provision.
Any questions? And given the nature of relatives, and going back to something Ms. Bowser talked about earlier, this might also be considered a safe harbor provision for you as well.
Mr. Chairman?
Madam?
May I just go back, I'm sorry, to the non-solicitation section and ask that instead of using the words mass mailing, we use mass communication?
Instead of mailing?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Is
that's
that
a good catch.
Because mm-hmm. perhaps email or things like that.
Definitely.
Email, telephonic, and who knows what's going to come next.
Yeah.
Smoke signals.
It does say, or other anonymously directed means that may be incidentally addressed to or include parties. It was intended to try to capture all.
I just think even the focus on mailing is, it dates the document.
It is true. I'm a digital dinosaur. So, all right, is computer.
Maybe anonymously directed means is sufficient.
So is there a sense to change it to mass communication?
All right. People comfortable with mass communications? Okay. Is there a motion to that effect? Just to make sure I know we're going to do a catch-all motion at the end, but just to make sure we're good on that.
I'll make the motion, but I just want to make sure I understand that anonymously directed doesn't mean that it's incidentally addressed. I got it. So if something is addressed to somebody, doesn't mean that it's anonymous, but that's okay.
I don't think they have to go to occupant. I think that is the, I think the sense was, I mean, mass communication, I believe, is the main sense. If you send three requests for donations out to an individual, that's not going to be mass. But if you send out your normal campaign requests to a broad range of people,
and so that broad range of people could include people who are doing business, but isn't targeted at people who are doing business.
Including WMATA employees.
Correct.
Just as a matter of organization of this section, I'm just wondering if it makes sense to include number four at the top, or part of number four at the top, which says, these bona fide types of solicitations are excluded from the following.
If they're done in a collective request as opposed to an individual request. I mean, I think that's the point.
Mary, can you turn on?
I'm just too far back. I was thinking about this from my church point of view, just to get it out of the political. Mm-hmm. I serve on my church board of trustees. We're doing a capital campaign. A letter goes out with my signature at the bottom to everybody in our community saying, here's the campaign, here are the reasons for the campaign. That's not precluded. Even if I hit,
correct,
you know, Dave Kubitschek and Rich Sarles, who happen to live in Arlington. So I think that's, to move it out of the political and just think about, or as Artis says, you're on the board of a large foundation and you do regular solicitation. But the key here is the exclusion is about large communications as opposed to individually, that anonymously driven is not about the people receiving it. It's about how the list is created.
Well, we could, and Phil was suggesting using widely or broadly instead of anonymously, mm-hmm. if anonymously creates some seeming internal conflict. So.
I think that makes sense. Now, may I just ask also, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, ma'am.
So the non-solicitation paragraph starts with the word gratuities, and it seems to be the catch-all phrase for any type of solicitation. Definitionally, what do you see as the difference between a gratuity and a bona fide solicitation in that it's religious, charitable, or political? Because I think in the vernacular, if there's a difference. So is it the intent of this paragraph to say a gratuity is anything that one might solicit?
The definition is on page 2.
Well,
you have a definition on page 2.
Gratuity is a defined term going back to
page 2.
Page 2, thank you. Which it has to be offered to the board member, for instance, because of the member's position on the WMATA Board of Directors, and did not pay fair market value and is not offered to the public generally. So gratuity implies an intent to influence the director and is a different term, and that's why it's capitalized throughout.
Okay. Any other questions?
No, I think that's satisfied. I think I just would like called out more distinctly the difference, because it's in the non-solicitation section. It should be clear that a bona fide religious, charitable, and political contribution is not a gratuity, and it is an accepted solicitation. It just seems to blend into this section a little too much. I think
part of the problem is that we're looking at the red line. Paragraph 4 does say that provided that all the foregoing are satisfied, a member or a household member may solicit a bona fide religious, charitable, and political contribution.
Okay. So I'll just be satisfied.
I think sometimes it's hard. Absolutely. I'm using the red line because it calls out the changes, but it does sometimes make it hard to see the flow of the provision.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so we're back to your motions now. The terminology was widely circulated mass communication. Is that?
Is that
the language you suggested?
I think what we suggested is by mass communication. This is in the.
Going back to the anonymous, we changed that to, I think what you said, widely.
Widely distributed.
Widely distributed. Mass communication.
And presumably you meant to do it in the previous paragraph also, which also has the same two words in
it. Yes.
Okay. All right. So your motion would be to make those changes in both places. Is that correct?
So moved, yes.
Okay. It's been seconded.
Second.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstain? Okay. Ms. O'Keefe?
Thank you. So let's see. Moving on to page 7. So, committee agreed to delete what was former section H on that page. That's really redundant. And then Article 4 addresses the filing of the disclosure forms and the new requirement that any party with an actual or prospective business relationship with the authority shall, prior to bidding on or proposing on or entering into a financial transaction, file a statement in substantially the form provided in Attachment D, disclosing all interests that board members have in that party or in the financial transaction of which the party has knowledge or should have knowledge. that's a new provision in the ethics code, as is C, which requires board members to disclose to the board any known or suspected violations of the code of ethics. And then D provides a hotline option for people to the Office of Inspector General for reporting violations of the code of ethics anonymously. On page 8, there's a new section, Article 5, creates the ethics officer, and it provides that the executive committee shall designate an authority employee to serve as the ethics officer. Now, on this, we did take the MWA Code of Ethics as a model to a certain extent.
Mr. Chairman? Yes, since I had requested that this be in here. The point was to have specific duties identified and who you go to. I just want to be certain that the executive committee could designate the general counsel to be the ethics officer, but that there be a specific ethics officer responsibility that you can look to.
Okay. Any other questions or comments on that? That's the last change.
Right, so the duties are, an annual review of the financial disclosure forms, discussing potential conflicts, advising members concerning the application of the Code of Ethics, and preparing ethics training materials for members on an annual basis. Those were the duties that were assigned. The committee specifically directed that the ethics officer not be charged with the responsibility for investigating allegations, which is part of the MWA ethics officer's responsibilities, but the committee agreed that that wouldn't be appropriate here. And there's an entirely separate path for investigating allegations of misconduct that has been determined.
Good.
So that's that new section. And following up on that, and because there's been more detailed provisions for responding or addressing allegations of misconduct in Article 6A, we simply removed the reference to the General Counsel and clarified the procedures again in this ethics code for addressing specific allegations of misconduct. And I believe, other than conforming changes to the attachments and to the forms, that concludes the changes to the ethics code.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, ma'am.
Does the forfeiture section, how does that comport with the compact's ability for jurisdictions to appoint their members?
That's a question that has never arisen. The compact also provides under the conflict of interest provisions that a board member found violated the provisions of the compact, which I might point out are narrower than the provisions of the ethics code. But in any event, the penalties are forfeiture of office or invalidation of the contract, the affected contract. So we've never had to address the issue of a conflict between the ethics provisions of the compact and the appointing provisions. But this is what I would say, that the specific governs over the general. And the specific in this instance would be provisions for addressing ethics violations. And in my view, the board of directors has full authority. So it would have to be worked out, obviously, but since the board is the only and sole determiner of a violation of ethics and the compact provides for the penalties, it appears to me that that takes precedent over the other provisions of the compact. I hope we never have to have that little constitutional problem.
Okay.
But it's your opinion that the board has the authority to remove a member?
Yes, for the specific provisions of the compact. Now, let me be clear about that, because as we've discussed, and those are essentially taking a bribe and having a specific interest in a transaction, not a member or party to a transaction, but a transaction itself. So having an interest in the outcome of a transaction or taking a bribe. The board in the past has expanded the ambit of the ethics code beyond those two provisions of the compact. And I would not say that the board members have the ability to remove for the other violations. So it's a little tricky, but.
So, Mr. Chairman, so there could be a circumstance in which a board member is found to have violated the code of ethics, but could not be necessarily caused to leave the board, but the board could take some action short of that.
I believe that's correct.
So that's where it says at the discretion of the board, they could decide whether it rose to the level of a compact violation.
The compact really addresses simply a couple of issues. And of course, those issues are at the heart of the integrity of the process. But the board in the past has implemented the compact in an expanded way.
Mr. Chairman,
follow-up.
So does this reference to Article 3, Section B, that refers to the Code of Ethics, not to the compact? It's on page 8.
Article 3B sets forth the compact prohibition.
That is a reference to the compact?
Yes.
Okay. Could you make that more clear, that that's a compact reference and not a code of...
So, what's the page?
The reference is to the code, right? But that section of the code quotes the compact.
You could just put compact section 10 in parens after it. On page 8.
I'm sorry, could you speak up?
B says it comes from compact section 10.
Yeah.
So you could just put compact section 10 after section B in parentheses so that it's clear it's the compact.
Okay. Any other questions?
I'm sorry. So
I'm just asking
slow on
Carol
this.
That it's
on
clear
page 8.
It's a double reference. So you reference the code Article 3, Section B, which references compact Section 10.
Right.
I think it would make it clear that the primary reference to the compact, which drives the action, is also noted there.
Right, exactly. And so I understand what you're saying.
Yeah,
right.
I think you can leave, as Ms. Hines suggests, Article 3, Section B, but add an additional reference there.
To the compact, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree. That's that makes it clear.
Yeah.
That's a good clarification.
Okay. Any other discussion on that? Mr. Chairman,
the issue of removal of a board member, I think, is probably limited directly by the provisions in the compact. I've often thought, though, that nothing in that in relationship to an action that the board might take would preclude the board from making a public recommendation to the appointing authority for removal. That's obviously a option that the board could exercise easily within its power and would probably achieve the same outcome.
Very good. Very good. Any other questions, comments? Thank you, Ms. O'Keefe. Yes.
And I know when we get into this kind of topic, you can think of all kinds of scenarios. So let me just raise one that also caused me to read it 3 or 4 times, which was under Article 4, submission of disclosure forms. And initially, when I focused on business associates, as we define it, it's an individual. And so the question for me was, if my employer were to become involved in soliciting or responding to an RFP for the agency, the nature of a university, we have people who conduct research on transportation. So what would be my obligation or the obligation of the university? Again, keeping in mind we have, you know, 1,200 faculty members who may choose to submit a proposal, unsolicited or solicited, to provide research services for the agency. What would be my obligation, and to what would be the obligation of the university or that faculty member?
So in terms of that, you know, the disclosure. Because I thought about that as we revised the indirect financial interest provision. But it is addressing an individual. A business associate is an individual, not a party, which is a broader, it could be a corporate entity. So what I am going to say is what I thought about, that the intent was to address very close affiliations with the board member. Your obligation would be to recuse yourself. As far as the university's obligation, since you would not have an actual interest in that transaction, unless you were going to be directly funded from the transaction, that would be a little bit different. Now, you would also be employed by that party. So under the provisions of recusal, you'd also be obligated to recuse yourself.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? Hearing none, I'll entertain a motion to adopt the Code of Ethics as amended through our various motions during this discussion. Is there such a motion?
So moved.
It's been moved, seconded by Ms. Hampshire-Cowan, that we adopt the Code of Ethics as amended during this discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstain? Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Just for clarification. So all these changes that we just made, somebody's going to go upstairs and do, because the board's going to adopt this at our meeting, yeah, at 11
o'clock.
Somebody
in the person of Bill.
who should be thanked mightily, by the way.
Yes.
But so we're yes, ready to roll on this.
Yes.
Sure. One request. It had nothing to do with adopting this, but Carol?
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Could you, when we have adopted the Code of Ethics, and we already have adopted the bylaws, and we've adopted the procedures, and I assume you'll put them in some form where they're readily referable to.
Yes.
And I'd suggest you add the legislation adopted by the three jurisdictions, because you really don't get a complete picture of governance unless you see those. We aren't adopting them, and they aren't controlling on the authority, but they are on the board members. So I think it'd be good to have all that in one place.
You mean the qualifications?
The qualifications, the reporting requirements, and the like, just so that you know that they exist.
All right. We can do that.
Very good. Okay. One final word. You weren't here at the beginning of the meeting. Let me once again thank Mr. Barnes and Ms. Hines, who shepherded this through the Governance Committee prior to my taking over today. And I just want to thank you for all your hard work and effort, and I think it's been reflected in this document. And also note that there were a couple of issues that came up that I think we will be discussing, and the Governance Committee has an ongoing responsibility to continuously review these codes and procedures. So there will be opportunity later in the year for any other revisions that the committee thinks is appropriate. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Also to add, to make sure, because the committee also has the, we also need to know what the authority itself is doing with its many thousands of employees. So if you could keep the committee up to date on the ethics code that the employees follow, the disclosure requirements for employees, and the training requirements for employees, I think that would be very helpful.
Okay. Well, Madam General.
Based on the committee's direction last week, we're taking a look at the employee ethics, still referred to as standards of conduct. There is an annual electronic training, I can tell you that. But there are some provisions of the standards of conduct that are somewhat dated, so we'll have to update those. Now, some years ago, the board delegated to the general manager the ability to make changes to the standards of conduct, provided those changes were consistent with the original standards of conduct that the board approved for the employees. So you'll have to determine whether you want to see them again or whether you want simply to be advised of the changes that have been made. And there are definitely some updating changes that will need to be made.
Okay. Well, why don't we put that on the agenda for an upcoming governance committee meeting where we get a report on those various documents, and then we can make a decision as to what, if any, changes we want to make. Okay. The last item has to do with the upcoming agenda. We just alluded to one, and that is looking at, on a continuous basis, the procedures, the bylaws, the code of conduct, code of ethics. We also, during the course of the year, will be looking at the issue of board orientation, because we will be having at least one new board member coming on shortly, and we want to make sure that that particular process is one that we're all comfortable with and that this committee participates in. Also, board development is going to be an issue we want to discuss, looking at opportunities for the board to engage in some professional development during the course of the year. So we'll be surveying the various options that might be out there during the year and informing the board members and looking to see what options you might wish to exercise. Staff development for our direct reports will be something that we'll be focusing in on, because this committee has gone through an evaluation process and we've noted certain items. And we want to talk with our direct reports about what staff development plans they need to develop in conjunction with us to move forward. And the last item, and I haven't had a chance to have this discussion yet with the chairman, is the role of the governance committee in the strategic planning process. And I'll be reporting back to you after he and I and the vice chair have had a chance to talk. Any other items to come before the committee at this point? If not, I believe we have a motion to go into executive session.
What we have to do is adjourn. The next session is the executive.
Okay, good. All right. With that in mind, is there a motion to adjourn, which is a non-debatable motion? All right, so moved and seconded. All those in favor of adjourning, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed can stay while we go upstairs. Thank you. We're done.